on the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Leo XIV issued the first major document of his pontificate, even as he announced his first major papal trip, this time to Lebanon and Turkey. This week on Register Radio, we're joined by EWTN News senior Vatican correspondent and editor Frank Rocca. And then, the country of Armenia is the oldest Christian country in the world. What are the challenges it faces today? We talk with Register European correspondent Solen Tadier. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio and EWTN News' vice president and editorial director. I'm here in our Washington, D.C. studio, as always, with Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. Welcome, Shannon.
Hello, Matthew.
Well, Pope Leo continues to remain in the news. Last week, we had his press conference relating to the Supich-Durbin controversy. And this week, we've had two major announcements, as I was saying. The release of his first apostolic exhortation, Dilexit Te, focusing on the poor. The new document, the first major writing of his papacy, was partly inherited from Pope Francis, who had been drafting his own teaching on care for the poor. And at the same time, the announcement was made of the first papal trip for Pope Leo to Lebanon and Turkey. Well, to unpack all of this news, we're joined by Frank Rocca. Welcome back to Register Radio, Frank.
Thanks, Matthew. Thanks, Shannon. Glad to be here, as always.
So here we are with the first major document under the time of Pope Leo. I guess the question is, it was said of one of Pope Leo's predecessors, Pope Francis, that his first major document was a work of four hands because he inherited something from Pope Benedict XVI. Can we say something similar about Dilexit Te?
Well, evidently, yes. Leo writes in the document that he inherited it and that he added some comments of his own. So he basically attributes it mostly to Francis, and we can see Francis's hand in it, certainly many citations of Evangelii Gaudium, Francis's own apostolic exhortation from 2013, the first major document of his pontificate. And so I think, the themes, the style seems to be more organized, more methodical, more historical, more heavy on citations to the church fathers, church doctors, to scripture. Matthew and Shannon, I don't know if you agree, but it seems like it's more in keeping with the temperament and the approach of Pope Leo. But the content and the argument, I think, is certainly very Franciscan.
Yeah, one of the descriptors you didn't use, Frank, was political, and we're right in the news business, so of course we're going to be looking for some political news there. I know other journalists at the Vatican were asking about that. That's not what we see here, correct?
Well, right. I mean, he says, you can't rely on the free market to solve all the problems, and there's great inequality. So you could certainly infer some, but there are certainly political implications there, absolutely. But there isn't what, Evangelii Gaudium made the front page news, and President Obama quoted the line about, everybody cares when the stock market drops 10 points, but nobody cares when homeless people die on the street. And it had a critique of global capitalism, and sort of there was this Wall Street versus Main Street narrative. So yeah, very different approach, much more based on, focused on personal conversion, but still, but still very, very emphatic that actual, work of charity and generosity and almsgiving and addressing inequality is essential, not a sideshow. So in that sense, it's very emphatic that it's not some nice little thing that goes on as an adornment of your faith.
I remember when I think it was Lumen Fidei came out in 2013 that Pope Francis largely had, as we were just talking, inherited from Pope Benedict. There was a temptation on the part of some of the analysts to go through with a red pen, blue pen, and to try to figure out which paragraph was Leo's or Francis's and which paragraph was Benedict's. I don't have the impression that that's something that we can necessarily do here, or is that something that you think could be done?
No, I'm certainly not such an exegete of the papal documents, so I could tease out the different strands. As I say, the political point that Shannon makes, I think, is true. There's less of an emphasis on that. And again, it just seems more organized. And Francis had a more kind of erratic and very spontaneous style, even in his documents. They didn't have the clever classical structure. And this seems more more traditional in that approach. One thing that I noticed that struck me is that this way, it's also returned to tradition. I mean, the title is, for a citation from the Book of Revelations, Jesus is saying, "I have loved you," and it's addressed evidently to the poor in some sense. You have little strength, you have little power, but I have loved you. But that's the only instance in the entire document where the poor are addressed in the second person, whereas Francis occasionally did do that. He would say, dear migrants and refugees, mm-hmm. or he'd say, to you who are poor, which is a kind of a break from tradition. And now we're back to that. So the poor is sort of this, we talk about the poor, and it's kind of curious, because I thought, well, if Leo is right, there are increasing numbers of poor all over the world, and many of them read and are parts of the church. But there is a curious, very traditional thing to be talking about the poor in that way, and then instead of talking to them.
Yeah, I thought it was one of the real edifying things from this, which is reflected in the first news report we got from this from Catholic news agency, Hannah Brockhouse. Was that the poor are not only objects of charity, but also evangelists who can prompt us to conversion through their example of weakness and reliance on God. He writes, "The poor can act as silent teachers for us, making us conscious of our presumption and instilling within us a rightful spirit of humility." So that was really an interesting way of couching that. And in Matthew, this is a topic that we keep talking about in regards to Leo, is this sense of balance. Mm-hmm. So, of course, there's a large section of this which talks about the material needs of the poor.
Right.
But then there's a section that also deals with their spiritual needs. So I don't know what you thought of that.
Yeah, he places a clear emphasis on a pastoral care of not just how the poor can also benefit from the spiritual care that we can provide, but how those who take care of them benefit spiritually. This is, I think, a major part of the charism, and Pope Leo discusses that in some detail of the different congregations and communities that are out there engaged with this. We always go back, I think it was Pope Francis who used the phrase, sort of building on Benedict, that we're not an NGO. There's a reason why we do this, and I think that's why he also places so much emphasis in the early parts of the document on teasing out the scriptural and patristic origins of the church's concern for the poor, because we go back to Christ himself.
I'm thinking of Wisconsin. I'm sorry, Frank. I couldn't help but think of the Wisconsin Catholic Charities case,
yep.
the Supreme Court case. You had this would have been a good document for the legislators
yes,
in Wisconsin to have read to understand how we approach this issue. Sorry, Frank. Go ahead.
No, at all. I think he says, he keeps coming back. The poor are absolutely central. They have a privileged place. They are the flesh of Christ. We seek Christ in the poor all the time. But it's interesting how, speaking again of political implications, he uses that term, the preferential option for the poor, which came out of the in the late 1960s out of the Church in Latin America and the was associated with the theology of liberation and kind of a very radical approach to social justice. But he doesn't deny that, but he is more like it's a more again rooted more in personal conversion and in devotion and in traditional concepts of charity. So in a way, he kind of recasts that term.
Another material consideration of this you touched on it was his call for almsgiving, which he notes has, kind of fallen out of favor among many of the faithful, not just here in the United States, but worldwide. I wonder why that's been the case, but I also think about the fact that during his predecessor's tenure, those Peter Pence and other charitable endeavors that were led by the Pope really suffered, particularly here in the United States. And so one of the stories that we're, really watching as Leo's pontificate evolves is, will he engage the United States in that way again? And really, these initiatives really need the support of American Catholics.
Yeah, well, I think the problem with Peter Pence, frankly, was that when it became known that Peter Pence was being used to fill up a budget deficit for the Holy See rather than going to charity. Now, strictly speaking, that was okay. Canonically, legally, the Pope has, it's for the Pope's ministry. So, you know, paying the bills of the Vatican is certainly part of that. But the way it was received and understood, and in most cases publicized, was as a way of, you know, funding charitable operations in developing countries and everything. And it hasn't been used for that for a while. So I think that may be something the Pope will fix as part of his financial reforms.
Yeah, and Frank, we do have to visit the fact that Pope Leo himself is going to visit Turkey and Lebanon. It'll be the first apostolic journey of his pontificate. He's going from November 27th to December 2nd. What's the backdrop of this? Why is he going to these two countries?
Well, Turkey was already a commitment, as you know, that Pope Francis had made for this 1,700-year anniversary of the Council of Nicaea, which, of course, is very important for many reasons, and most famously it led to the formulation of the Nicene Creed. So it's an ecumenical thing, especially with the ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, the Orthodox Church. So it was known from almost the start of this pontificate that he would keep that commitment. Lebanon was more recently added and a bit of a surprise. The last papal trip to Lebanon, I was on it in 2012 with Pope Benedict, and there was a bit of anxiety about security and so forth. And Pope Francis wanted to go and repeatedly planned to go and was never able to go. So this is something that the church in Lebanon is very happy about and very grateful for. It's this country that has suffered enormously, that has a huge, huge, I can't remember the proportion now, with millions and millions of refugees in a small country. It's just unthinkable. Even the people that I remember, Cardinal Cerny in the Vatican, said he was a great advocate for migrants, and said that, you know, maybe Lebanon is the one country that can say we have taken enough, because they've been overwhelmed. So that will be over dramatic. And then, of course, always the dialogue with Islam, which is an important thing, and has been for decades. And that's obviously Lebanon is a key place for that.
Yeah, Frank. Also, a couple of other things. Briefly, he also met with members of the media and had some interesting things to say about the role of the media this week and the importance of communicating the truth. Always good for us to hear those words. I think you'd agree with that.
Yes, that's true. He did. He did. And he also, a very telling comment, what is becoming his regular Tuesday afternoon or evening media scrum outside of Castel Gandolfo before he comes back. One outlet tried to ask him about ICE raids in Chicago and the Trump administration. He cut him off and said, I don't want to comment on political choices in the United States right now, which coming a week after he had commented on the Durbin question. So I think that's interesting. He, in terms of his press messaging strategy, whatever you want to call it, we now see that he wants to steer clear of explicit political comments, which was not the way of his predecessor always.
Yeah, and I think we can assume that we are starting at least to see something of a media strategy or an approach on the part of Pope Leo to dealing with the pesky world media. Frank, we count ourselves among them. So, Frank, as always, much appreciated.
Thank you, both of you, Matthew, Shannon. Glad to be here.
Well, you're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Next up, we talk with Solène Tadier and ask the question, is Armenia at a crossroads? Stay tuned to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen here on Register Radio with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, Armenia, of course, is the oldest Christian country in the world, and yet it is facing a multitude of threats, including from its neighbor, Azerbaijan, and widening tensions between the government and the Armenian Apostolic Church. That begs the question, is Armenia at a crossroads? To discuss all of that is Solène Tadier, who's a very important figure in these discussions. She is, after all, the European correspondent for the National Catholic Register, and she has just returned from a trip to Armenia. Welcome, Solène.
Thank you very much.
Well, the last time you were a guest on Register Radio, we were talking about Joan of Arc's ring, a happier topic. This time, though, we're at the point now where really important discussions have to happen on the situation facing Armenia. Can you give us a little background, first, of what your trip was there to accomplish, and then where we are in terms of the Armenian questions?
Yes, absolutely. It was a fascinating trip I took there in Armenia with the U.S. organization Save Armenia. We were a delegation. Most of the participants were from the U.S., from other organizations. It is designed to really help us raise awareness around the world about the fate of Armenia, because since it's not such a strategic place for many countries, no one cares about what's happening in Armenia, but Armenia literally faced an ethnic cleansing less than 2 years ago, exactly 2 years ago, to be precise. We just had the anniversary of the invasion of Artsakh, Nagorno-Karabakh, where over 100,000 people were displaced. Everybody basically had to leave Artsakh, Nagorno-Karabakh, and just flee to the rest of the country, to Armenia, to leave the enclave. And so it's a huge human tragedy. So we were there for the week, and I could meet with a lot of refugees, with political leaders as well, to discuss the everyday life and how they are reacting, how they are dealing with the everyday life 2 years after the war. What are the concrete threats that they are facing right now? And it seems to be still the case, although now you have the peace treaty with the intercession of Donald Trump. It does not prevent Azerbaijan from still having some kind of expansionist aims towards Armenia because of the public discourse. You know, a lot of cities in Armenia, they rewrite history explaining that it has always belonged to Azerbaijan, and that's when solid historians are very needed here. So it's been a quite fascinating trip with very different layers, very different types of realities, but that convinced me even further that as journalists and as Christians, if we don't do the job of really be a voice for them, they have nothing left because they don't have the resources that countries like Azerbaijan have. So we are basically everything they have left.
I'm happy to say that Solène is really one of the few journalists in the world, at least for U.S. Mm-hmm. in the U.S. media space, that has paid close attention to this conflict. Of course, a lot of other big things have been going on in Ukraine, in Gaza, here in the United States with the presidential election, and so on. So, but Solène has really paid close attention to that. Every time she does write about this conflict, we face the question, how do we explain this to our readers? Matthew mentioned in the opening that Armenia is the oldest Christian country in the world. Can you just give us a little picture of the religious background of this conflict?
Yes, so Armenia, in the Caucasus region, Armenia and Georgia are the only two Christian countries. And basically, Armenia is surrounded by Muslim countries with Turkey. And of course, many people, I hope, know that they underwent a genocide a century ago perpetrated by Turkey. So they have Turkey, Azerbaijan, Iran. So the countries on all the southern borders are all surrounded by Muslim countries. So it's actually the world's oldest Christian nation, yes, because the first Christian kingdom saw the light during the 4th century. So we can literally say that it's the oldest Christian nation. And so the stakes are very high. You know, in this very strongly, predominantly Muslim region, the fact that we still have this strongly Christian country. So over 90% of the population belongs to the Armenian Apostolic Church. I can say that it belongs to the Oriental Orthodox family, so they are not Catholics. But they have very good relationship, actually, with the Catholic Church. We know that they had a joint declaration in 1996 with John Paul II, reaffirming their common roots. And they made it possible also for faithful to receive the Holy Communion when they go to the Catholic Church and vice versa. So we tend to have very good relationships. There is a small minority of Roman Catholic faithful there, but the big majority, over maybe 90%, according to the latest figures, belong to the Armenian Apostolic Church. And of course, historically, since it's a very, very old institution, the church's influence on the society extends, of course, well beyond a religion. It's shaping also the cultural, the political life. And so that's why right now the situation in the aftermath of the war with that Azerbaijan, it's extremely tense between the religious leaders who are like political leaders and the government. It is creating a kind of chaos because, of course, after a defeat, it's very difficult to restore a kind of stability. And so it's raising a lot of concern even among the diaspora worldwide, because several key figures, key religious figures, were arrested over the past few months and jailed under the accusation of plotting against the current government, Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan's government. So the situation right now is extremely difficult for Armenia, because if this balance between the government and the church that is extremely powerful is jeopardized, then it's threatening the whole future of the country and the trust of the possible new investors in a moment when Armenia is trying to survive while boosting its economy, trying to attract foreign investors, especially from the US, Christian investors, to strengthen the country. But if there is this strong opposition between the government and the church, we are wondering how the country will face all these challenges.
Yes, so what exactly is behind Pashinyan's very hostile rhetoric and treatment of Christianity, of the Apostolic Church for Armenia?
So in general, so we know that the tension have been growing for months and months. And we know he has a very bad relationship with the Catholicos, so the head of the national church, Karakin II. We know that Pashinyan has been attacking him on the basis of moral issues, accusing him directly of having a double life and having a child or things like that. So we are talking about like violating clerical celibacy. So we are dealing with very harsh mutual attacks. So of course the church, the national church there, is accusing Pashinyan of using this rhetoric to basically counteract their legitimate, in their view, opposition, because they criticize Pashinyan for giving up on all the battles that are really important for the country, the recognition of the genocide by the international community. Pashinyan thinks that it's not so urgent, and for him the emergency is really to restore bonds with Turkey, to boost the economy of the country. And for the church, the local church, the recognition of the genocide is an absolute key issue for the long-term survival of the country, because of the support from the international community. So you have like some key issues that will shape the orientation of the country in the long term that are dividing the current government and the church. So of course, Pashinyan is also accusing the church of being still under the Soviet influence, just 3 decades after the fall of communism, of the Soviet Union. Pashinyan is accusing a lot of key leaders to be still under the dominion of Moscow, and because they are Orthodox, so he's accusing them of having this strong domination. And some observers say that it could be partly true, but only partly, because a lot of them have no ties whatsoever with Russia. So it's a very complex reality. And as a journalist, as Christian journalist, it's sometimes it can be tricky to really look at the situation with objective eyes and try to really understand what's at stake and to point out the need to restore a balance as soon as possible to strengthen the country in a very, yeah, very difficult context, a very hostile context.
Exactly. Well, and we are very grateful for your reporting on this. Your piece, Armenia at a Crossroads, the Church-State Rift is Testing the Nation's Future. We also want to point out your interview. Armenian Archbishop decries international indifference to his people's plight. All fruit from your visit to Armenia. So thank you for that. Again, as Shannon noted, you're one of the few journalists out there really covering this story with any understanding of the complexity of it. We also have to give a shout out to Armenia that it produced one of the doctors of the church, Grigory of Narek. So it's a testament to the significance of the Christian history in Armenia. And Selen, thank you again for your reporting on this. Well, that's it for Register Radio this week. On behalf of my co-host, Shannon Mullen, and our producer, Michael McCall, remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks again for joining us here on Register Radio. Until next week, please take care and God bless.